had to sell my car to pay for the DUI. So I didn't have a car. So I was borrowing my friend's car to go to jail. But I couldn't always borrow my friend's car. But then I was like leaving early to get drunk, to then drunk drive myself back to jail. And then I would park and have them validate my parking. But I'm in jail for a DUI. I don't have a driver's license. I'm drunk driving myself to jail. I was like just taking the piss because I was like, these cops are so stupid. I'm like, why are they validating my parking when I'm in here for a DUI?
Welcome back to the Locked In with Ian Bick podcast. I am so excited to have comedian and podcast host Brittany Schmidt on the show today. I got the opportunity to interview her and listen to her incredible story when I was in Los Angeles at Spotify Studios. Shout out to Spotify for letting me use their studio, and I'm looking forward to filming more episodes there. Brittany's the co-host of the podcast with Brittany Furlan called This Is The Worst. It's actually titled This Is The Worst, and it's a podcast they launched a couple months ago, produced by Just Media House, and it is insanely funny. I'd listen to this episode, episodes of their podcast every week, and I crack up. The two of them, the two Britneys, yes, they're called the two Britneys, are so funny, and I definitely recommend you guys check it out. But on today's episode, Brittany shares her incredible story of her battles with alcohol and the trauma she experienced as a child and into her early adulthood, and how that ultimately landed her into some trouble. And then we get to find out how Brittany was able to turn it all around, turn it into a successful career in comedy. I'm excited for you guys to hear Brittany's story today, and I hope you guys sit back, relax, and get ready to lock in with Brittany Schmidt.
One of the co-hosts of This Is The Worst podcast.
Yes.
Probably one of the fastest growing podcasts, I'd say. It's coming together.
It's great. I mean, I love Brittany, and it was like the whole idea was just we voice note and we talk every day, all day, and we're like, wow, this is like funny and entertaining. Why are we just entertaining ourselves? So We decided to make it a pod, and I don't want to say it like blew up right away, but it's doing well, and we're like very grateful for everyone who's tuning in and listening.
Yeah, and what I look at it as, you guys have grown so much in the first episode.
Yeah.
Like even you yourself, because Brittany's, I know, is a little bit more comfortable, the other Brittany,
yes,
Furlan, because she's done a podcast, but yeah, you have just like, I listened to the last episode, and it was so much different from the first episode in a good way.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean? I'm
so
very curious by that.
So a couple things was, like, one, like, when you were looking down at like, the phone and the iPad questions, you're so much more comfortable now with it. And I know you guys are, like, looking on the screen now
to
do it.
Yeah.
And you're just having conversation, and you're just, I don't know,
it's easier.
Show.
And I noticed it's funny, too, because, you know, you don't see stuff until it's played back, but like I would like play with my hair and like my face, and that's just like me being like nervous to be on camera. And Brittany is so still because she has been doing this for so much longer than I have. She's done a podcast, she's also been like a public figure for a long time, so I'm like figuring it out, but she's like my big sister.
Yeah, I mean, you're a public figure now too.
I know, but she's been one longer, much longer. Yeah,
and it's interesting getting to know someone through social media. Like, I know all of these things about you.
I know.
But I don't know who the real Brittany is.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to learn through someone, because social media has this way of, you know, teaching you things about a person.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get to meet them and talk to them, you kind of find out more. And
yeah,
that's like the art of podcasting and learning and whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah. There's lots of, I'm very multifaceted.
So you know, where did you grow up? Where are you from?
I grew up in a little town called Big Bend, Wisconsin. It's a truck stop of a town. It's 1,200 people. It's right outside of Milwaukee. So when people ask where I'm from, I just say Milwaukee, because nobody's ever going to know where I'm from. The closest thing we got to knowing where I'm from is Waukesha, which is the county that Big Bend is in. Remember when there was that parade and that guy like ran people over with a car?
Mm-hmm.
That was Waukesha. So we've got like, you know, some maniac put Waukesha on the map. So I'm like, now people kind of have a little bit of a sense.
How far was Oxford from you?
I don't even know. I've never even heard of Oxford.
That's where I was in prison. I didn't even know of it either. Oxford, Wisconsin.
Okay. It must be northern.
I couldn't tell you.
You don't know. You didn't even look at a map when you were in prison?
No,
you didn't.
I thought they were sending me to England when they said you're going to Oxford.
That's really funny.
Yeah, because who
you're like, I'm going to read my first book ever. I'm going to finally read a book.
I'm going to England. That's what I thought, because I went on Con Air. Like, you ever see the movie Con Air? with Nicolas Cage?
No.
You got to watch that.
Okay.
So I, you know, handcuffed, chain shackled, send you on a plane, and I went to Wisconsin.
Yeah. And you thought you were going to Oxford. You thought you were going to where Stephen Hawking went to school.
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, turns out, from prison to fucking Stephen Hawking's living room. That's
I know,
where I'm going.
Exactly. Yeah. So what kind of family did you come from? Was it?
Oh, gosh. We got to start there.
Well, you know, we always like to start at the childhood.
Yeah. No. Very, very dysfunctional, but we always tried to seem like we were great. Like, my mom's side of the family was very WASPy, and they always acted like nothing was wrong ever. And then my dad's side of the family, my dad has 12 brothers and sisters, and they, you know, grew up definitely lower class. Like, they were all kind of like fighting for food growing up, and it was, I think, a little bit gnarlier on my dad's side. But then, like, my family unit is my dad, my mom, and my sister. I have an older sister who is a year and 9 months older than me, and we get along great now, but when we were kids, it was really tricky because my parents started getting divorced, I think, when I was like 5 or 6 years old. I mean, they got divorced then, and then their divorce lasted, I think they were in court for like 7 years. So pretty much all of my childhood, I just remember, was a divorce. Like, it was the parents were fighting over, you know, before they started getting divorced, they were doing well. They had, you know, money and land and property and all of this. And we were getting fucking ponies for our birthdays, and like, things were good. And then, you know, the longer you fight in court, the less you have because you're spending all the money on lawyers. So my dad finally just gave up, and he stopped fighting over all of the property and the monetary stuff. The only thing he was fighting for was custody. My mom wanted full custody. My dad wanted split custody, obviously. That is what ended up happening. But my mom, you know, like, when you're a kid, you don't know, like, you have a parent that's maybe mentally ill. You just know you have a mom who's different than the other moms. But I, like, kind of started putting it together that my mom wasn't, like, all right in the head. And she was a real tough mom. Like, she was a real tough cookie. When I was young, like, we had to have perfect grades. We had to be in, you know, a bunch of different sports. We had to be the best on the team. It was a lot. So she had, you know, as we kind of went along further in life, and as I've, like, talked to therapists and all of that stuff, have concluded she had undiagnosed borderline personality disorder. And it was too tough. It was too tough for me to maintain a relationship with her, like, in my adulthood. We tried on my 18th birthday. You asked one question, I just, like, went off the fucking deep end. You're looking at me, you're like, you're like glazing over.
Because I've heard bits and pieces of the story.
Yeah.
In of like in a comic setting.
Yeah.
So to hear this is, like, different. And that's what I like, to give someone the opportunity to tell it in a different format, because that's how you get new listeners and a different perspective of you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she was just really brutal. Like, when I was growing up, you know, she had an eating disorder. And that in our family, she would literally send us to school with, like, a Slim Fast shake and a brown paper bag as our lunch. And she would put a potato in there to fill up space. She didn't want us getting fat. We had to be the prettiest. Like, I mean, it's so embarrassing the way that I looked in my school pictures. Like, I looked like JonBenet Ramsey in my school pictures. Like, you know, kids are kids. They have, like, bowl cuts and, like, buck teeth. And I would come in with, like, curled hair. She wouldn't let me cut my hair. My hair was down to my hips. It was, like, fully curled. And I'm like, you know, she didn't put makeup on me, but I was, like, the most glamorous bitch when I was, like, 7, which is a lot, because everyone's like, who does this bitch think she is, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, everything had to look good, but then nothing, like, we were great students. We, you know, like I said, we were athletes, we were everything, but nothing ever felt good. The family was always in turmoil. We were always fighting. On like Father's Day, she did many years ago. Many years ago, I was probably 10. She did, like, one of the most fucked up things ever. She took my sister and I to a hotel the night before and was, like, feeding us, like, ice cream and, like, just, like, having, like, letting us swim and do all of this stuff. And I was like, something is amiss. Like, something's, because she was never that nice. She would never let us eat ice cream. I was like, something's definitely wrong. And then the next day was Father's Day, and she brought us home late. And my dad was waiting for us, and he had been waiting for like maybe 2 hours. And she did it on purpose. You know, she always used us to make my dad mad and would like try and keep us from my dad. And my dad was mad, and he was like rightfully mad. And he like sped up the driveway really fast. We had a quarter mile long driveway, and he like sped up the driveway. And he was just like, you know, I don't know what went on between them. There was definitely no violence. There was no, he was not. He might have, like, raised his voice at her, but he never yelled. Like, my dad's not a yeller. And she, like, just faked this whole thing and was like, kids, get inside. We're not safe. And, like, hit us and called the police and got my dad arrested on Father's Day.
Wow.
And I just remember she was just, like, fucking bananas. Like, she always ruined, like, I don't know if this is something that's specifically that borderline people do, or if this is just like something fun that like my mom did, but like she, if it was ever a holiday, it was like her Super Bowl to like fuck shit up. You know what I mean? Like if it was a Christmas, a birthday, whatever, she, it always ended up being about her, and like she always made everything really, really challenging. And then to that point, like on my 18th birthday, I came home from school. I'm like, I'm 18. And you know, all throughout my, like, adolescence, I wanted to go live with my dad because my dad and I just were, like, homies. Like, he was a really, really good father. He was very strict. He would get, you know, I respected him, so I listened to him. And I didn't really respect my mom because she was so, like, violent and angry and mean, and people didn't like her. And I just kind of was, like, she kind of gave me the ick. So I always said I wanted to go live with my dad. And in Wisconsin, legally, when you turn 16, you can pick what parent you want to live with. And I said, I want to go live with my dad. And she started fighting it. My dad was like, it's not worth it. He's like, it's just 2 more years. Just hang in there. Like, we don't want to go back to court. Because, you know, she's like, I'm going to tell the police that he's an alcoholic and that he's letting you drink and all these things. So my dad's like, please, please, please just stick it out. So I did. And then on my 18th birthday, when I got home from school, I'm like with two of my friends, and all of these boxes were on the front porch. And I walked up to them and I noticed it was all of my stuff and a note on it that said, if you ever step foot on my property again, it will be considered trespassing and I will call the police. And I was like, this bitch. I'm like, I wanted to move out. Like, you don't get to kick me out when I wanted to move out. It's like quitting when somebody fired you. You know what I mean? Yeah. I was just like, okay. And yeah, so I was like, great, see you later. And I packed my shit up and I went to my dad's, and my dad was like, we have to go to the bank, you know, because she's the custodian on your college fund. And I was like, okay, why? And he's like, we just have to go get your money because I was supposed to go to ASU for school. And I just wanted to go somewhere warm. I wanted to just like get out of Wisconsin. And we went to the bank and I'm like pleading with the teller. I'm like, please, please, please. I need this money. I'm going to ASU in a few months. I need to give them my deposit. And she's like, you're doing what with this money? And I was like, I'm going to ASU. And she's just like, honey, there's $16 in this account. So she drained my college account. And I just sat there and I was like, this bitch, she got me again. She got me again. So I just, you know, my dad laughed in my face. He's like, I knew she was going to do that. Cause it's like when shit is bad, you have to just laugh. Like my dad taught me that. Like I'm crying. He's laughing. He's like, this is exactly what she did to me when, you know, we got divorced. Like I knew this was going to happen. And, you know, so, family life was always difficult. It was always hard. My relationship with my mom was always, always very hard. We didn't talk after that. And then she resurfaced in my life. I went to UW of Milwaukee because that's where I had a scholarship to go to school because I had $16 nowhere else. I could not afford anywhere else. And she found out I was going to that school, and it's not a good school. And, you know, everything has to look good for my mom. So she like came in, she intervened. She, like, lied to me and she told me she was dying of cancer. And she's like, this is my dying wish that you go to Marquette and get out of this school and go to this other school. And I was like, okay, whatever. And then, like, you know, we found out she was not dying of cancer. She did have, like, some stuff with, like, amavium in her lungs, but she wasn't dying. And then she got me into Marquette, which is actually honestly probably the best thing she could have ever ever did for me, because Marquette was fucking great. And then, yeah, she ended up killing herself 3 days before my wedding. So
before your wedding?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's one way to RSVP.
How do you feel about that when that happened?
Honestly, when I got the call, I felt so relieved because she was in such turmoil on this earth. Like, I didn't ever look at my mom and be like, she's enjoying this. You know what I mean? Like, she was always fighting someone or something. Like, she was never, you know, she just was never content. She was never okay. I think later in her life, when I wasn't really around, she got a little more addicted to pills. Like, she was taking pills to sleep and then taking anti-anxiety while she was awake. And it's just, like, she wasn't – she couldn't get it. She couldn't figure it out. And then she would never admit that she was mentally ill. So if anyone ever said to her – like, I did say to her at one point when we had our last falling out. So, like, when I moved to California, I got a DUI and – I ended up having to go to jail, and we can get into this later. But I got a DUI, and she called me, and she's like, I fucking told you you're going to be an alcoholic just like your dad, rah, rah, rah. And I was like, at this one point in my life, I need you to be a mom right now. I don't need you to be, like, the fucking person that's telling me I told you so, you know, or being, like, a villain. Like, I'm in a bad place right now. And so I told her, I was like, listen, if you ever want to get help, I will fly home. Because at this point, I lived in LA. I was like, I will fly home to go to therapy with you. I will be there with you. But until you get help, I cannot have a relationship with you. And I meant it. And I didn't speak to her again. I blocked her phone number. I blocked her emails. And, you know, I had a weird feeling. Things were getting really bad. Everyone else in the family started cutting her off. My sister cut her off. And my sister was always her girl. You know, like, my sister, like, growing up, it was always kind of like me and my dad and my sister and my mom. Like, no, it's not like we officially, like, wore jerseys and picked teams. But it's like, it was, like, kind of an unwritten thing we had. You know, that was kind of the allegiance. And my sister cut her off and uninvited her to her wedding. And then everyone else started falling away. And when everyone cut her off, I was like, I was still drinking at the time, and I got very emotional, and I was like, she's going to kill herself. She's going to kill herself. She has nobody and nothing. She has nothing to live for. She's out of money. This is not going to end well. And I wrote her, like, this long email just being, like, pouring my heart out about it, like, how much I loved her and how sorry I am, like, that her life took such a turn and just that she was so alone and just that, like, you know, I loved her and I always loved her and I just want her to get help and, like, let me know if I can help you. And I was, like, going back and forth on whether or not to send it. And I went to send it and she had deactivated that email. And then I tried to call her and she had changed her phone number. So I couldn't even get a hold of her, but I knew what was going to happen. And then when I was the night, I think it was like the night before I was getting ready to leave because my wedding was a destination wedding in Nicaragua. Right when I was getting ready to leave, I went out day drinking with my ex-husband and I got really, really drunk because when you block somebody on iPhone and you block their phone number, you can go into your messages and there's all block numbers. They can still leave a message, but they're just not, you're not going to get notified about it. So I just had like this pit in my stomach and I listened to them. I had a message from my mom and I listened to it and I was like, she was like, hey, you know, just calling to tell you I love you and I'm so proud of you and I'm so happy for you. She's like, I'm going on vacation to Northern California. Don't worry, I won't be down by you, but I just want to tell you, like, I love you and I'm really proud of you and I hope everything's going well. And it was the first time in my life my mom had ever left me a voicemail that was just nice. Like, she might start off nice where she'd be like, hey, just calling to check in anyway. Anyway, like, the Donald Trump is in my lights. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it would, like, always take a really hard left and it would be like a scary voicemail. But this one was just sweet. And then I got hammered because I knew, I was like, in my head, I was like, it's it. This is it. She's done. She's, like, gone. And I got blacked out and I don't remember this, but I, like, fell. I was, like, in bed, and the next morning I woke up, and my ex-husband was like, do you remember what you said last night? And I was like, no. And he's like, you said that your mom's dead. And I was like, oh, yeah. He's like, why'd you get so drunk yesterday? I was like, well, she left me this voicemail, and I, like, told him about it or whatever. And I was going to, like, run some errands for my wedding, and I got a call from my aunt, and I just remember thinking, it's a little too early for you to be calling because my wedding's not for like a couple days, like about the wedding. So picked up the phone. She's like, are you driving? And I was like, yep. And she's like, you need to pull over. And I was like, is it my grandma or my mom? Because my grandma, her mother was terminally ill with cancer. She said, it's your mom. And I said, how'd she do it? And she said she shot herself. And I was like, yep, that tracks. And I felt just such enormous relief. I was just so happy. Not so happy my mom was dead, but so happy she didn't have to keep struggling and keep making everyone in her life struggle, because her existence on earth was a ripple effect in our family of like everyone that had to deal with her. Like, she just didn't bring anybody peace. You know, she stressed everyone out. So, and then of course I'm devastated because I'm, you know, I'm fucking sad. My mom's dead. That sucks. But I think the biggest feeling I felt was relief.
Do you ever think that if that email was sent and got through to her, it would have had a different outcome?
I think, you know, I'm spiritual now and I'm like sober and I do believe in God. And I really believe that God prevented that email from being sent, because I do think that if that email was sent or if I had gotten a hold of her, I think if she has somebody to like suck the life out of, that's like what was keeping her alive, which was like draining everyone. So I do think if I would have opened those doors to her, I think maybe it would have bought her more time. I think ultimately, like, what was going to happen was supposed to happen. I think God's plan is perfect. Like, what happened is absolutely what was supposed to happen. And I remember my grandma at the time, you know, she was obviously devastated. Her daughter just committed suicide. And my grandma was very Catholic, very religious. And she was praying and praying and praying. And was like, why did this happen? Like, what, you know, why, like, what could we have done differently? And she just kind of got a download from the universe being like, this is exactly what was supposed to happen. So, yes, I do think the email might have changed the course slightly, but I ultimately don't think so. Because I think even if I opened that door to her, if she was still the same way she was to me back in the day, probably 100 times worse, because I hadn't spoken to her since 2012, I would have had very little tolerance for it. I'm like, if you're not going to get help, you know what I mean? It would have probably been like, maybe things would have actually been nastier if we opened the doors of communication.
You know, the universe works in mysterious ways, and I'm a big spiritual person too. And I listened to what you said to Alex and Jordan on their podcast about how like fate kind of brought you to meeting Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you guys were both divorced.
Mm-hmm.
She needed someone to help get her through it. And you guys end up in Paris together.
Yeah.
And now you have the podcast.
That was wild too. I mean, like, sometimes I get really strong downloads from the universe. They don't happen often, but when they do, they're strong. And after the first time I talked to Alex, a literal download from the universe was like, you need to go to Paris with this girl. And I was like, I ignored it because I was like, that's insane. I just talked to her on the phone for 20 minutes. And then she posts something on her Instagram that she's either going to Paris or London. I was like, go to Paris. I'm going to try and come. And then like for a minute, we thought our schedules weren't aligning and it wasn't going to happen. And then I realized I had her dates wrong and I was in Toronto and I could just fly right over to Paris. So I was like, pack me clothes, bitch. I don't have clothes for Paris. Like, I was in Toronto doing shows. So I have like, you know, my stand-up clothes, which are very casual. I'm like, pack me clothes for Paris and I will meet you there. And that was like Alex. My friendship with Alex is another like complete godsend.
Do you think it was more mental or more like a gut feeling, or how do you describe that feeling? Because I think a lot of people could relate to that in some sense.
Yeah, it was just a very strong thought that came. It was like I hung up the phone and I was like, you should go to Europe with that girl. Like, you should go to Paris with that girl. And I was like, that is an insane thought. Like, I just talked to her for 30 minutes. I don't even go to Europe with like some of my closest friends. You know, traveling with someone is – it can fuck a friendship up. So like it was just a really wild download. But yeah, usually when I get downloads, they are like – they're mental, but they just come through me. And it's like, you know, you have that voice in your thought that's like – always nagging you and telling you you're a piece of shit and nothing's good enough. And like, I think that's like a lower voice. Like, that's a very low vibrational voice. When I get like a download, it's like almost like a beam of light, like just goes through me. And I'm like, this needs to happen.
I love how we're on a podcast. You're calling it a download.
Yeah.
That's a perfect fit for
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever look back and think about how your childhood has affected everything that's to come? Like, you know, even leading to jail and leading to comedy and everything. Like, if you didn't experience that kind of – it's trauma. You know, you did go through trauma if you didn't experience that. Because I know a lot of your pieces are on your childhood trauma, too.
Yeah. I mean, I think – so here's the thing. Like, my mom and my relationship with her was one incredibly difficult part of my childhood. But another incredibly difficult part was, like, the people at school. I was bullied pretty mercilessly all through school. And, like, I was actually just in New York, and I was talking to one of my best friends, Kate, about this. Because she was, like, one of my, like, ride-or-die friends in high school. But she was the only one. Like, everyone else was horrible, horrible to me. And I was telling her, I was like, I kind of feel like being bullied when I was a kid prepared me for being bullied as an adult, like, as a comic. Because I get, you know, I get all these crazy comments on my page telling me, saying horrible shit about me. And it's so painful to read. Like, I think people think when you're at, like, a certain level, you're not a real person and you're not, like, looking at this and you're not receiving it. And, you know, oftentimes I do take Instagram off my phone because I do think it's, like, really bad for people's mental health. But I think, like, all of it prepares you. Like, I couldn't have picked a harder career. Like, point blank, period. Being a woman in comedy is, like, it's fucking tough. So, yes, I think all of that prepared me for this. I don't think I would have been a strong enough person to pursue my dreams if I didn't get tough when I was a kid.
So you ended up finishing 4 years at Marquette?
I did.
And what was your degree?
I did a communications major with a psychology minor.
Oh, psychology.
Yeah.
Are you using the psychology stuff now or no?
So the psychology minor was really – I took because I wanted to figure out what was wrong with my mom.
Okay.
Like, I really – I was very curious about that. And then I also am like – I'm always just curious about people and how they interact and why they interact in the ways that they do. I've always just been a very curious person about that kind of stuff because I'm like – I definitely want to separate – you know, it's like my dad always says when someone says something negative to you, like, consider the source. It's like I always want to separate a person from what might be mentally inhibiting them. Like, if you are a narcissist or if you have borderline or if you're bipolar, like, you do communicate differently in the world. And I'm always trying to, like, understand that. I'm always, like, very curious about it. But I'm not, like, actively pursuing psychology. I'm not, like, Sigmund Freud over here. You know, I'm just, like, I observe people. And I think the observation of humanity is part of comedy.
Do you think people give you a hard time in the comments because they don't see this side of you?
100%. And I've had so many people tell me, like, present this side of yourself on stage. And I'm like, I almost don't know how because I'm so scared to be vulnerable. Like, sitting here and talking to you, you're a stranger. Like, I don't know you at all. And I'm so comfortable doing this. But there's something about, like, on stage and my persona. Like, I my persona is, like, this tough chick. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like a bad bitch and, like, nothing fucking bothers me. And I'm like, I couldn't be less that. You know what I mean? I'm so bothered. I'm so, I'm often sad. I'm wearing a sweatshirt today that says I cried today. Like, I'm like, you know, I'm a soft person and I'm, like, very sensitive and I do, like, want people to like me and it hurts my feelings when they don't. But also, like, I know that, like, the art that I do is, not everyone's going to like it. You know, I'm very dark. I'm very edgy. I do not prescribe to anything society has told me to do. I just, like, go in the opposite direction. So I forgot what the question was.
No, just about if people saw this side to
you. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I could totally see you having, like, another podcast where you show this side of you.
Yes.
Like, just, like, doing the interviews and – because Alex said, like, you're incredibly smart, and I hear that on the show and whatnot, but I feel like the world doesn't really get to hear the side of you, and it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, listen, I'm early in my career. I think that, you know, I have another good 20 years in me to figure out how to – 20 is, like, being generous, maybe 10.
No, you'll get more than 20.
15. Maybe 5.
What's the life expectancy?
Like, another day. Like, I think about quitting every day. No, I do definitely – because, you know, I think ultimately, too, like, comedy for me started by, like, I want people to laugh at my pain because ultimately they're laughing at their pain or things that, like, I think – laughing through really tough things is – it's medicinal. And I do want to help people. I want to be of service. And, like, I think until comedy can't do that anymore, like, if there's a point where I'm like, okay, this is no longer serving anyone, this is no longer, you know, doing what I want it to do, there will be a world where I pivot and I, you know, open up a little more about this kind of stuff. But I don't know. You know, some of it's so sad, too, that audiences don't know what to do with it. Like, when I try and talk about it, like, for so long, I have a joke about, you know, my mom and the stupid Slim Fast Shake. And I was, like, trying to figure that joke out for, like, a year and a half. And I believed in it so much. I was like, I know there's something funny here. But for, like, a year and a half, I was working on it. And audiences are just like, this isn't okay. You know what I mean? Like, you're talking about a 10-year-old being given a Slim Fast Shake. Like, that's not funny. So it's, like, finding the funny in that really dark stuff. You know, it takes time, and that is the craft of it. But it's really hard to go on stage and be like, oh, my life was hard. Because also people look at me and they're like, shut the fuck up, bitch. You know what I mean? No. Like, people just see what they see, and then they make their assumptions, and they don't want to hear it.
What was your first job out of college? Because you got into corporate, right?
Yeah. I actually was very fortunate. I worked at an advertising agency in Venice Beach called Zambezi. It was Kobe Bryant's ad agency, and it was run by a guy named Brian Ford, who to this day is like one of my mentors and my best friends. So he worked at Wieden & Kennedy, which is the biggest ad agency in the world, I would say. And he worked on Nike, and he did the Witness campaign with LeBron James. Do you remember that one? We Are All Witness.
Maybe it was
like it was like a he worked on a bunch of big. Or did you remember the Hate It or Love It campaign with Kobe?
I could have been in jail during that time.
Yeah, you were in prison. You're like, I wasn't watching commercials. So anyway, he did like a bunch of these iconic campaigns at Wieden. And then Kobe was like, you're the dude. Let's go start our own shop. So they started a shop in Venice. And then I was a intern copywriter. So I was working on like Champ Sports and Pop Chips and all these brands, like writing, you know, taglines and like all of it, like everything you would see on their campaigns. I was like helping them. I was an intern, so I didn't really know what the fuck I was doing. Like very few things got through to like final rounds. But yeah, I did that and I loved it. It was like 15 people in Venice. It was a really small agency. It was so cool. And then it grew really quickly. And then they moved me over into creative recruitment. And then I kind of just got stuck in creative recruitment. And I worked in corporate America up until 2019. So I did headhunting. And then before that, I worked internally at Media Arts Lab. I was the head of recruitment there, which is Apple's agency of record. So I kind of like blew through it, and I did it, and I was like, I hate this. Like I hated it. I didn't feel creative. I started comedy in 2012, but I was doing it like I was such a drunk, and I was like doing it as a hobby, and I was like showing up wasted. I was like, woo, like with very serious comics. Like Damon Wayans was on a show. I remember Theo Vaughn, Neil Brennan, like all these guys immediately. And I'm like a brand new comic, and I'm just like showing up hammered. Like it was not a vibe. So I stayed in corporate America. I did like a few comedy shows a month. And then, you know, I ended up getting sober and going back to comedy.
Why did you even decide to get into comedy in the first place?
So that actually is because I was going to jail for my DUI.
You got
to
tell us this story.
Yeah. Okay. So like I said, I'm from Wisconsin. And in Wisconsin, you can get like 4 DUIs before they call your landline and they're like, hey, stop it. So I went to visit a friend in Arizona for Christmas when I first moved out to L.A. I went to go visit a friend in Arizona because I couldn't afford to go back to Wisconsin. The flight was like $600 and I could not afford that. But a flight to Arizona was like $70. So I was like, I'm going to go do this. And I remember I got so drunk I missed my flight to Arizona. So I had to like buy another flight. So I'm already like in the red. And then I get to Arizona and we went out. And I was with one of my girlfriends from college, and she was with one of the girls that she was working with out there. And we all went out, and we were drinking our asses off. And I remember right before we left the bar, I took, like, 3 shots of Jameson. And then we were leaving. She's like, she was going to drive. And then her friend was like, you can't drive. The laws here are so fucking crazy. Like, if you get a DUI, it's over. And I was like, I'll fucking drive. And then, like, Paige, my friend, goes to hand me the keys. And she hands me the keys. But she, like, dropped them. And then I picked them up. And then I dropped them. And then, like, get in the car. It was just, like, a very messy handoff situation. And I pull out. And I go, got to one stop sign. And I got pulled over. And I was like, but what did I do wrong? I was like, I am a great drunk driver. Like, I didn't do anything wrong. And there, I didn't say I was a great drunk driver. I was like, I know I didn't disobey any traffic laws, but they were doing a sting. And the cop just saw me, like, fumbling the fucking keys and then getting in the car. And he's like, I'm just going to take a wild guess. And then, yeah, I got a DUI, and it was an extreme DUI. So when they drew my blood, it was a point... 0.18. It was a 0.18. And I'm like, I was so grateful that they didn't wait a second longer to draw my blood, because I was like, those three shots of Jameson are running through me right now. Like, they're right here. So I'm like, please take my blood as fast as possible. And I was so lucky that they did, because 0.18 is, it's bad. So Arizona has a zero tolerance policy for drinking and driving, which I really think every state should have now. I didn't think that at the time, but it's like, if you have one beer, you go to jail.
Oh, and just one.
Just one. Yeah. There's no, like, legal limit, none of that. It's not 0.08. You don't get any leeway. It's like, if you've drank at all and you're driving, you go to jail. Those are the rules. And I was like, that can't be real.
So you wanted to test the theory.
Yeah. No, I didn't even know about the theory. I literally, the DUI is how I found out about it. And they're like, okay, so this is an extreme DUI and a 0.2 and above. So an extreme DUI is 30 days in jail. And then 0.2 and above is, like, it's a whole different ballgame. I don't know what it is now, but I think at the time it was like 6 months. And it was Tent City, which was an outdoor jail in Arizona. And it was just, like, horrendous. So I got a lawyer, and I fought it, but they threw the book at me. They were like, because I was a fucking asshole. When they pulled me over, I was, like, I thought I was being, like, funny and cool. I was like, let me just, like, suck your dick. And, like, oh, and I was like, you know, whatever. And he's like, no, bitch. He's like, also, don't say that, you know? Like, don't do that. So I... There was, like, a moment where I thought I was going to get out of it, because my lawyer was like, they misfiled your paperwork. So they have 30 days to refile it, but they don't have your headshot. They don't have anything. They don't know where anything is. They can't find it. So unless they find it, like, you're off the hook. And so then I started, like, partying and celebrating like I was off the hook. I was like, whoa, like, let's fucking go. And then, yeah, no, they refiled it. And then they gave me 30 days in jail. And I think it was 6 months with a breathalyzer in the car. And I ended up going to jail at the Beverly Hills Pay to Stay, which is in Beverly Hills. It's where you pay and you can do work release. So I wasn't going to lose my job. I had to have my boss sign it, which was crazy. I'd been working there, like, only for a few months. You know, like, I was an intern for 3 months. I was full time for August, September, October, November, like 3 or 4 months before I got the DUI. So I'm so grateful for Zambezi and everybody who worked there who, like, signed off on me going to jail at night. Like, the fact I was able to keep my job was truly just a miracle. But I was so defiant. Like, I was still such a defiant alcoholic about it. Like, I had to sell my car to pay for the DUI. So I didn't have a car. So I was borrowing my friend's car to go to jail. But I couldn't always borrow my friend's car. But then I was, like, leaving early to get drunk, to then drunk drive myself back to jail. And then I would park and have them validate my parking. But I'm in jail for a DUI. I don't have a driver's license. I'm drunk driving myself to jail. I was, like, just taking the piss because I was like, these cops are so fucking stupid. I'm like, why are they validating my parking when I'm in here for a DUI?
They didn't check it at all?
No, nothing. I mean, they're That's why I just had no respect for the law. I was like, you guys are fucking idiots. I thought I was so much smarter than them. And then my last day, I got, like, hammered. And when I was supposed to be at work, it was, like, a Saturday, though, so I didn't have work. And I went and got a tattoo, got, like, shit-faced drunk. And this is, like, when I had a BlackBerry, so I didn't have, like, GPS on my phone. And I couldn't, like, I was so drunk, I couldn't remember how to get to Beverly Hills. Like, I was just, like, and so I was, like, 45 minutes late showing up to jail. And I mean, the way that I sweated when I got back to jail late, and they're like, I have a tattoo, like, I have cellophane on my ankle. They're like, what's this? I'm like, nah, it's just nothing. Don't worry about it. And then they just put me in the cell, and I was like, this is it. This is this is actually the end because they caught me. I got a fucking tattoo. I'm late. I'm wasted. I'm like, I'm probably going to like prison. That's mm-hmm. what I thought. I was like, prison's next for me. And then the next day they like knock on my door and I was like pit in my stomach. I was like, I really did it. Like I really fucked up. And the guy was like, so we can't release you. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. And they're like, until, you know, 45 minutes past the hour because you came late yesterday. So you do have to serve this extra 45 minutes. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? And I was like, none of that was, you know, I was deep in my alcoholism at the time. So I was not even close to considering stopping drinking. I just was like, I got away with it.
Have you heard of prison talk, like on TikTok? Uh-uh. So there's this, like, you know how there's different talks?
Mm-hmm.
So there's this thing called prison talk, and there's a lot of female influencers that go to jail, but uh-huh. they do the weekend stay.
Uh-huh.
So is that literally you're just like surrendering on a Friday and you're leaving Monday morning?
Yes. So for me, I couldn't get out for the first 48 hours. I had to be in jail for 48 hours. And then Monday through Saturday from 8 to 8, I could go to work mm-hmm. if they signed off on it, which they did. I never worked Saturdays because I worked in a corporate job. So Saturdays I was always partying. And then I remember in that sentence was like the 4th of July too. So like I got out on the 4th of July and went to a fucking party. And I have like a joke about it in my first special. But it's all, you know, it was just like I was a menace. I was absolutely insane.
So when you go to the jail, are they like putting you in a jumpsuit and stuff and you leave your weekend clothes like separately?
No. So the jail, I mean like Beverly Hills Pay to Stay is like, I guess it's kind of a joke. It was like I had my own cell and it was like a futon bed. And then I also had a little couch and there was a TV. It was like a tube TV, but it was a TV. And if I put on Comedy Central, because I would always want to watch Tosh, I would put on Comedy Central. But Comedy Central synced up to the Beverly Hills, their cop monitors, so I could hear what was going on in all of Beverly Hills at all times, which was like the best of both worlds. I was getting Tosh, and then when I wasn't getting Tosh, I was getting like a housewife overdosed on pills, like getting all the fucking tea about what was going on in Beverly Hills. But it was like I had that, and then I had a sink and a toilet and a mirror. I think the worst thing was the mirror was like polished metal because you can't have glass in there, and I had contacts at the time, so it was like really hard to get my contacts in. But that was the biggest complaint.
Was it like bars on the door too? Is it an actual cell?
Yeah.
Wow. So you got the actual jail experience.
Yeah.
How are the guards treating you? Because you're.
They were, like I said, they were so nice.
Even though you were an asshole.
I mean, they were just like, they were as nice as they could be. Like, they were like, hey, you're still in jail. You know what I mean? Like, chill out. Like, but.
Is this like where Lindsay Lohan went? Didn't she?
No, Lindsay actually did a. What I should have done is what Lindsay did. Lindsay went to county, and Lindsay got immediately discharged because they're like, we don't – this is not what we're dealing with. We have bigger fish to fry. But I couldn't risk going to county and then them saying, you're in. You know what I mean? Them being like – them not discharging me. I couldn't risk that because then I lose my job. I lose everything. I have to move back to Wisconsin. I have failed. I go home. You know what I mean? Like, so I couldn't risk going to county. Lindsay went to county and she, I think, got discharged in like 12 hours.
And they let you just switch states to pick your own place?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's why I had to lawyer up. I had to get a lawyer that was like going to be able to help me finesse that because I couldn't have done that on my own.
That's a great deal.
Yeah.
What about the food? Was it any good?
You had to bring your own.
Wait, you brought your own food to jail?
Yeah, because nobody's in this jail. Like, it's literally, it's like if somebody in Beverly Hills gets put in jail overnight, that's where they stay. There's like four jail cells and then there's this pay to stay cell. It's literally like a weird little apartment jail. And then you have to bring your own food. You bring your own blanket. You bring your own pillow. Like,
what kind of jail is this?
It's like kind of like white people jail.
Summer camp. It's like summer camp.
Yeah, it's like white privilege jail.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you think it taught you anything? Do you think it was like a deterrent at all or no?
No, but I mean, so you, the thing you asked me in the beginning was how did you get into comedy, I think. And the jail, so I was so depressed because I was like, this is a branding crisis. Like, I'm not somebody who goes to jail. This is fucking horrible. I hate this. And I was really sad and I was really depressed and I was deep in my alcoholism. And there was a guy that I worked with at Zambezi who sat across from me. His name was Tamer Catan and he was a comic and he was quitting advertising to go be a comic. And he was like, you're really funny. He's like, I know you're going through some shit right now. He's like, you should try comedy because it is like therapy, but it's cheaper. Like, because I couldn't afford therapy. I was out of money. I spent all my money on this DUI. And I was like, okay, but like, no. And then he like quit and he would call me every day. And he's like, did you call that guy? Because there's a comedy teacher that I went to learn how to do comedy. His name is Jerry Katzman. I still work with him. I still love him dearly. But he called me every day and was like, did you call Jerry yet? Did you call Jerry yet? And I was like, no, no, no. Like, I'm not going to do it. I can't do it because the class costs money. I'm like, everything. I had no money. And he's like, bitch, he's like, scrape the money together, call Jerry. So I called him. I got into the class and it truly did like change my life. Like when I did my first comedy show, I was like, oh, this is like what I was born to do. Like it was a truly magical night. And Jerry has a rule, which is great, that you can't drink or use in the class, in the group, or while you perform the first night. So I was sober the first time I performed comedy, which I think a lot of people aren't, you know, if they are drinkers like I was at that time. And yeah, it was magical. And I was like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing with my life. But at that time, I couldn't see a way that I could quit advertising. I didn't see a world where I could just jump and the net would appear. Like that wasn't my mentality at that time. I had to kind of, you know, keep working and make a living.
Did you ever think deep about what caused the alcoholism?
Oh, you know, they say in AA that the genes load the gun and the environment pulls the trigger. And I think that's very true. I think genetically alcoholism runs in my family. Actually, on both sides, my mom's brother, you know, drinks a lot. And then my dad's family, there's a lot of alcoholism. A lot of them are sober now, too. I have two uncles that are sober, which is amazing. And my dad drinks a lot. And, you know, so I think genetically it was in me. And then environmentally, my mom being so tough and school being so tough and everything, like feeling like I didn't belong anywhere. When I drank, I felt like I belonged. Like it just made me feel powerful and confident and strong. And I finally was like, oh my God, I don't give a fuck about any of you. Like it just gave me the power to stop. Cause all my whole life I cared so much. I cared what people thought of me. I wanted to have friends. I wanted people to like me. I wanted this. I wanted that. I wanted. And then alcohol was just like, bitch, fuck all y'all. Like I was like, literally all of you guys can suck my dick. And that was like my entire personality until I got sober. And then I was like, wait, I'm still sad.
What was the final straw that it took you to get sober?
I got sober after my mom killed herself because okay. I think a lot of it was I was drinking at her. You know, I was so mad. She called me an alcoholic my whole life. She's like, you're going to be an alcoholic just like your father. And I was like, bitch, I'll show you an alcoholic. Like I took it as a challenge. You know what I mean? I was like, I'll show you that I can drink and I can have a successful career and a happy marriage and great genuine friendships and all of these things that she never was able to have, you know. And I was like, and I'll drink and it'll be fine. And then it's like, you know, as I got deeper into my drinking, I was like, this is killing me. Like this is it used to give me life and now it's taking my life. Like it's not, I was not showing up. I would not do comedy shows if they were on the other side of town because I'm like, I have to drink and I can't drink and drive because I already got a DUI, so I can't go. So I just like wouldn't do I wasn't doing comedy. I wasn't showing up for myself. I wasn't being a good partner. I wasn't being a good friend. I just wasn't like, I wasn't being the person that I wanted to be. Like I didn't identify with who I was when I drank. But I was like, I'm going to keep drinking because I still have to show this bitch, you know. So when she died, I was like, oh my God, thank God. Thank God I can stop. So the last time I drank was the morning after I got really drunk at my mom's funeral on December 10th. And then on December 11th, I had like a fucking mimosa. It's so embarrassing. It's such a like pussy way to quit. Like I just like had a fucking, yeah, I had a mimosa and I was like, I'm done. Like that's it. And then I started to, you know, I told my husband at the time, I was like, I'm done. And he was like, no, you're not. And I was like, okay, well, then I'm just taking a break. I think, like, for people to, for it to be palatable to people, like, my entire personality was that I drank. So for people to, like, understand, I was just like, I'm just taking, like, a little break. But I knew. I was like, I'm done.
What do you use as a substitute to that now to pour your energy into, to give you that life and that energy?
Oh, boy. I mean, I don't know that I have a direct substitute. It's like through my sobriety I've done, you know, the 12 steps and I do like prayer and meditation and like I try and just like stay even keel and like be a good person and keep my side of the street clean. I don't, but I'm not. There's no replacing that energy. Like the person I was when I partied and I drank and I was like, whoa, Like, that person, RIP to her, because she's like, I still have fun. Like, I just went to New York this last weekend and went to Saturday Night Live, and I was up till 7 a.m. like a fucking maniac sober. But, like, yeah, there's nothing that's, like, taking its place. Caffeine is it, but I also struggle with caffeine because then it, like, fucks my sleep up. So
yeah, I'm trying to get off the Celsius's.
Oh, my God. I had a Celsius yesterday. You'll listen to the episode. I had a Celsius on an empty stomach, and I was having a stroke. Like, I literally couldn't. I was mixing my words up. I was, like, having a fucking panic attack. And then, like, once you're, like, you notice you're mixing it up, I'm just like, I just sounded like a fucking bird on yesterday's episode.
And you had a
episode.
Bad Delta flight, too, right?
Oh, my God.
I saw the notes.
Yes, yes. Horrible. But, like, that's actually where I was, like, fucking my words up. I kept mixing up miles with money. I'm like, it was $100,000. Like, miles. It was miles, you know, but it was just, I kept fucking everything up. So.
Is it hard to stay sober in the entertainment industry, especially with the people you're around and whatnot? I know Britney's sober, right?
Yeah, Britney's sober. I surround myself with a lot of sober people, and I think, you know, I was very fortunate that when I got sober, I was married and I was living a pretty quiet life. I wasn't back in comedy yet. So I wasn't in the entertainment industry. So I got, like, a pretty good footing under me and, like, with my sobriety when I wasn't around it. I think it would be incredibly difficult to get sober around, like, if I had to go do comedy every night. It's just so easy. You know, you can be so sneaky. You can sneak off and go get a drink, and everywhere you go, they're like, what do you want? When you're a comic and you're on the road and you have a rider, they're like, what kind of alcohol do you want? And it's like, you know, I have literally on my rider, it's just like Celsius's and fucking, like, Quest bars.
Quest
so
bars.
So boring. Like, okay. Protein bars.
Yeah, you know? I've had those before. Yeah. So do you think it's more welcoming now in the entertainment industry to be open about past struggles with alcohol and drugs?
100%. I think most of the people that I'm close with, like, are sober or they don't have an issue with it. I think, like, the hardcore alcoholism and drug use of the past, like, you know, the Richard Pryor, Robin Williams era where it was like, that's what everyone did. You fucking blue lines until 7 a.m. And, like, that's just not what comedy is anymore. Like, if you want longevity in this business and in this life, and if you want, like, a meaningful life, like, that's, it's just not a meaningful life. Like, it's fun, and then it stops being fun. You know what I mean? Like, it is not fun forever. It's fun for, like, a short pocket of time. And, like, and if you're in that, fucking go get it. But, like, coke and all that shit is so scary now. It's, like, all fucking laced and everyone's dying. And I'm like, this isn't fun. This is, like, Russian roulette. Like, yeah. So I think a lot of people, you know, that I surround myself with are sober. Like, a lot of the people that I'm the closest with are sober.
Do you want kids one day?
Whoa. You know, I froze my eggs last year just in case. But kids have never been something I'm, like, dying to do.
I ask because I'm wondering if you're worried about passing on those genes that you have and what you've gone through onto them, like you were describing how it runs in your family.
Yeah. No. I would be more worried about passing on the mental illness. Truly. Yeah, no. I just – kids, for me, it's like if I meet the right person and it all has to make such perfect sense, like – I love freedom. I love being able to just hop on a flight to go to Paris with Alex. I love, like, just being able to get to do what I want when I want to. And, like, maybe one day that'll lose its flair, too, and I will want, like, a more meaningful, like, family or something like that. But, like, for now, it's not a priority. And I do, you know, there's a lot that you would have to – also, I donated eggs, so there's two, like, kids out there that are technically – genetically mine. So, like, I'm gonna call them in a couple of years and be like, how's it looking? You know, like, how they doing? Are they drinking yet? Are they drugging? What's going on?
Do you put your jail stuff into your comedy at all?
Mm.
I feel like that would do well as, like, as a woman that went to jail. Like, yeah. I feel like that's got some spark and spice to it.
Yeah, I put it in my first special.
And that was the one that went viral on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty cool. I was watching some of it yesterday.
Yeah.
It's at, like, what, almost 500,000 views?
Maybe, yeah. I don't look at views. I try not to get caught up in that. Yeah, it's just such a rat race. I think it's so unhealthy for us to look at, like, how many people. It's just, like, because then you attach your value to it. And I'm like, I just don't. It's doing whatever it's doing.
Do you and Brittany Ferlin want to use your platform to kind of help in the recovery space since you guys both kind of came from that?
I don't know. I think we're just trying to have a good time right now. Like, I think we're...
You're succeeding.
Yeah, I think we're just trying to have fun and bring some joy and some levity to people because it's a tough time. I think everyone, like, you know, people are anxious and depressed and sad and bummed out. And I think we're just trying to bring levity to people. And we're having really fun with the format as it is right now, but that's not to say it won't evolve. But I think, like, specifically helping people in recovery would be something so wildly different from what we're doing right now. Like, it might be a completely different project.
I think you indirectly help people.
Yeah.
Like, when you have people like Bunny on the show, or mm-hmm. like when you talk about your own stuff and mm-hmm. you kind of loop it into something funny and saying, well, we're sober now or whatever. Yeah. Like, it does that. And it has, like, I read all your comments, and because that's my job, I got to look at all that.
Yeah.
And people are, there's more positive
yeah.
than negative.
Well, I don't know what comments you're looking at, but yeah.
Well, on the YouTube, I would say they're
the YouTube, yeah. Well, YouTube also does this beautiful thing where they put the bad ones at the bottom.
And TikTok's starting to do that now.
Yeah. So they have all the good ones at the top, and you have to, like, go down to the bottom. And I think every site should do that. I was just watching a news clip the other day of Zuckerberg on, like, the Senate floor getting, like, yelled at by these parents who have lost their children to suicide and bullying online and all of this stuff. And I think about that often. I'm like, I am a hardcore bitch. Like, I am a tough girl. I've been through a lot, but I look at this stuff and it can fuck my day up. It can fuck my week up. It fucks you up. Mm-hmm. And I just don't even, like, there's no way to, like, not allow it because it's free speech. You can say whatever you want about, but I do think it should be, like, deprioritized if you're, like, clearly being a fucking troll.
Yeah, TikTok does the hidden comments now, but, like, I feel like Facebook and Instagram, they prioritize the hateful comments up
yes.
to the, Instagram's horrendous with that.
Instagram is all I have on my phone, and I oftentimes take it off. I don't even have TikTok on my phone. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, like, devastating to me that people even think it's necessary to just spew hate. I'm like, I always think, like, what is your life? Like, what position are you in that you're spending your energy? We get such a finite amount of energy as human beings, and you're spending some of it to take somebody else down. Mm-hmm. Like, unless you're really, like, doing something righteous and it's a really good cause and you, you know, really think you should be shouting from a mountaintop that someone's a piece of shit. It's just, to me, it blows my mind that people even do it.
And you don't know what someone else is going through.
Yeah.
Like, that one comment could be someone's tipping point, too.
Totally.
So that's the same thing as bullying.
Yeah. I mean, that was, like, the wild thing when I put that first special out, and it did do really well. And it made my social media following grow in a more significant way than it had ever grown. I think it went from, like, 50,000 to 150 or something like that. And, like, you know, when you get more people looking at you, you also get more people hating you. And from the outside, all of my comedian friends are like, oh my God, you're crushing it. You're blowing up. Everything's amazing. But meanwhile, personally, at that time in my life, I was going through a divorce. It was incredibly painful. I was in mentally probably the worst place of my life. And everyone assumes you're doing good because people are following you on Instagram. And I'm like, no, I'm literally doing worse than I've ever done in my life. And then I have all these, like, gremlin fucking stranger trolls telling me to kill myself. And I'm like, I fucking will. You know what I mean? I'm like, I'm right here. Don't push me.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, I know now when I, like, get to a point with Instagram where I'm like, it's bringing me, when it starts to bring me no joy, I just take it off my phone and I have a girl who runs it.
What's a piece of advice you'd tell your teenage self if you could go back in time, now that you know everything you know now?
Oh, honey. I would probably say, oh, God, I don't even know. And it's like, this isn't a new question. It's like, I want to tell her to not drink so much, and I want to tell her to not fuck so many guys, but, like, that's all part of the journey, you know what I mean? Like, that's all part of what made me who I am today. So it's, like, I probably just, like, everything is going to work out amazing. You're going to make it, and just fuck the haters.
Literally.
Fuck the haters. Yeah, literally.
Brittany, thank you so much for taking the time to do this. It means the world. It was
of course.
A great conversation. I'm
glad. Sorry you said four words. You literally said nothing, and I just went.
No, this is how my interviews go.
Okay,
we're not one of those podcasts where, like, it's like it's different, you know? That's why it works for us, and we've built this following, and, you know, and it's amazing having stories like this on here.
Amazing. Thank you for having me.